Yes, so thanks for inviting me, Steve, and twisting my arm about talking about mean flows in oscillatory double diffusive convection. It forced me to look at this problem in a different light, and I think we actually made some progress on that thanks to this conference. So I'm going to describe first what is oscillatory double diffusive convection for those of you who don't know what it is, and then I'll actually go into the meat of the mean field and mean flow generation in that system. So oscillatory double diffusive convection is an instability that occurs specifically because of diffusion. And the best way to understand it is to consider first a system that is simply stably stratified, and where the stabilizing component of the stratification comes from a compositional effect. So for example, if you imagine a system which is salty at the bottom and fresh at the top, this will be intrinsically stable, ignoring for the moment the temperature stratification. And in that salt-stratified system, you can support internal gravity waves. And so, for example, these would be a blob oscillating up and down in the fluid following the dashed line. Now, if you add even a very small temperature gradient that is unstable to that system, you can actually destabilize these gravity waves. And the way it works is that, even if the density remains stably stratified in general, and the way it works is if you take this blob of fluid and displace it downwards, it will pick up a little bit of heat from the surrounding. And so when it comes back to its neutral position, it's now a little bit more buoyant than it was before. And so it overshoots the neutral position more than it would have if it was a simple unexcited wave. And so it rises further. There it cools down significantly. And when it comes back here, it's cooler than its neutral position and then overshoots downward. And by doing so, you excite these gravity waves. And you can see that this relies very strongly on the fact that temperature can diffuse rapidly into the blob during a period of oscillation. And so the other thing, of course, is that you don't want the salt to diffuse rapidly into the blob at the same time. So this relies intrinsically on the temperature diffusing much more rapidly than the salt. Now here, I took the example of temperature and salt, but of course, any two diffusing quantities that can participate in opposite way to the stratification will have the same effect. Now, this is important on Earth, for example, in the polar oceans, where melting ice releases cold and fresh water on top of the underlying ever so slightly warmer, ever so slightly warmer water. But it's also much more, it's also very common in volcanic lakes, where you have the ground gases, the geothermal activity that releases gases like methane into the water of the lake. And as it dissolves, and CO2, sorry, and as it dissolves into the water, it makes it very dense. And at the same time, the water is heated from below. So you have, again, dense, warm water sitting underneath less dense, colder water. And in these systems, you do have this oscillatory double diffusive instability, but it's actually not very important. And I'll explain in a second why. Now, from an astrophysical point of view, on the other hand, the instability is really important, especially in objects such as giant planets. And the reason why we find double diffusive convection in giant planets is because we believe they're formed through this core accretion scenario, in which you start with a whole bunch of solid objects that bang into each other, so planetesimals, moons, etc. And once you have a large enough core, you can begin the rapid gas accretion onto that core. And so you end up with a differentiated planet with a lot of heavy elements at the bottom and a mixture of hydrogen and helium in the outer layers. And at the interface between the core and the envelope, you have this huge compositional gradient. So even though most of the planet is convective, near the core envelope interface, the compositional gradient could be sufficient to suppress convection and instead give rise to the oscillatory double diffusive instability. And that could have a lot of influence on the planetary evolution. Now, to model this system, we're going to use the Boussinesq approximation. And the main reason for that, if you remember, in order for the instability to develop, you have to have that temperature has to have the time to diffuse into the blob. And so these blobs of fluid are generally quite small. And the typical scale of the instability, therefore, is going to be quite small, and generally much, much smaller than the system scale height. So these are the various equations. So I have one for momentum, temperature, composition. And here I'm going to label composition as S. So if you want to think about a salinity, that's fine. And then there's a linearized equation of state. And sorry, in the Boussinesq approximation, as you might know, you consider either an evolution equation for potential temperature, or you need to subtract the adiabatic temperature gradient in that in the thermal energy equation. So what we're going to also do is use a periodic box to study the problem. And the idea is to think of a tiny region of the planet or of the ocean, much smaller than system scale height. And we don't want to be limited by boundary effect, so we're going to make sure that everything is periodic in all directions. Now, of course, you still need to impose a background gradient of heat and composition, of temperature and composition. And so we do that by letting temperature, say, be a linear background profile plus the perturbation, and it's that perturbation that's strictly periodic, and similarly for the compositional field. And so this linear background profile is imposed in the code, in the equations, and it's equivalent to thinking that any kind of perturbation is point to point, is equal from the top of the box to the bottom of the box, plus this offset, okay? But we're not imposing the temperature or the composition at the bottom or the top. And then finally, we're going to non-dimensionalize everything upon the typical scales and timescales expected to occur in double diffusive convection. So a typical length scale would be the thermal diffusion scale, and a typical timescale is the thermal diffusion timescale across that length scale. And when you do that, you end up with a system of non-dimensional equation, and there are three non-dimensional parameters: the Prandtl number, which is the usually defined one, a ratio of the diffusion coefficients for composition and temperature, and the most important parameter is called, in this particular case, the inverse density ratio. And that's the ratio of the compositional gradient to the temperature gradient, or the superadiabatic temperature gradient. And you can think of it as the ratio of the stabilizing stratification to the destabilizing stratification. So the larger this number is, the more stable it is. And the smaller this number is, the closer to being convectively unstable the system is. And this is illustrated a bit better in this plot. I'll come back to that slide. So in essence, if you don't have any compositional gradient, you just have that the adiabatic temperature gradient marks the transition between overturning convection, which is when the density is actually unstably stratified, to a stable system. On the other hand, when you add a stabilizing compositional gradient, you reduce the range of parameters for which the density is unstably stratified, and in a range a little bit above, you can allow for double diffusive convection. So from here to here, you're more and more stably stratified. Now, this upper limit for double diffusive convection, you can obtain it by linear analysis. So the nice thing is all these equations, the way they have been written, are all the variables are triply periodic, so you can use a very simple normal form, system to expand these quantities. And when you do so, you end up with a cubic equation for the growth rate of the perturbations. And as you know, a qubit has three solutions. And in this particular case, there's a real and two complex conjugate ones. It's very easy to show that the real root is always stable, and the two complex conjugate ones, on the other hand, can be unstable. So the complex conjugate roots are essentially these unstable gravity waves. And you can show that they're unstable when this density ratio is in the range between 1 and Prandtl number plus 1 over Prandtl number plus tau. And that's kind of really the key, because you can see that in the ocean, where the Prandtl number is 7 and the diffusivity ratio is about 1 over 100, this number is 1.14. So the range that is unstable to double diffusive convection in water is really tiny. On the other hand, in astrophysical systems, the Prandtl number is tiny. So typically, this range is something between 1 and between 10 to the 3 and 10 to the 6. So in astrophysical system, oscillatory double diffusive convection is actually very ubiquitous. And I guess I don't need to talk about the last part. So I'm now going to present some numerical simulations of oscillatory double diffusive convection. And all of the ones I'm going to talk about today are essentially in the same format. We have a cubic box whose size is 100d times 100d times 100d, where d is the unit length scale in the system. And for reference, a typical wavelength for the basic instability is something like 7 to 10 dB. So these boxes have about, well, 100 by 7 is about, 10 to 12 to 13 basic wavelengths of the oscillation in each direction. And the Prandtl number and tau I'm going to use are, some simulations will be at 0.01 and some simulations will be at 0.03. So they're fairly low Prandtl number runs. So I'm just going to show you two simulations without saying too much about their detail. The first one is going to be in a case which is very close to being convective, I mean truly convective. And in that particular case, so the system starts with the basic oscillatory double diffusive convection, which is this kind of wave-like turbulence. But very rapidly, you can actually see that you develop interfaces. I'm sorry, I should have said, this is the compositional perturbation that you're seeing. And so we have three interfaces that form spontaneously out of the system. And then you can see that this one is getting weaker and is about to merge with the middle one. And so now we have two layers separated by two interfaces in this periodic system. And then very rapidly, the lower one becomes very turbulent and merges with the middle one.
Do you keep on forcing, or is this an initial value
problem? No, so the background gradient is maintained. And that's essentially a source of permanent forcing to the system. Now, the perturbations themselves are not necessarily, the horizontal average of the perturbation is not necessarily zero. So you can develop a background profile that is the sum of the imposed one and the one of the perturbation that is not linear. But you always have this point-to-point temperature difference and this point-to-point salinity difference that is imposed across the box. Okay? Yeah, that's the whole domain. Yeah? No, so that's just the perturbation. If you actually saw, if you added the linear part, you would actually end up with a stepped function. Pretty much. So in the three-layer stage, it would be three steps. In the two-layer stage, there would be two steps. And in that final stage, it's just one step. It's just a little bit easier for the color contrast to see it this way. Now, one other thing that's relevant here, and I'm not going to discuss it too much in this talk, but with every single layer merger, there's a significant increase in the amount of turbulent transport as measured by the Nusselt number, which is the total flux over the diffusive flux. So this is the basic instability level, sorry, the level of the saturated basic instability. But then when the layers form, you have a jump in the flux. And when the layers merge, there's further jumps in the fluxes. So the emergence of layers and their subsequent mergers actually has a lot of influence on the total transport through the system. That's why we're interested in it. Now, by contrast, this is another simulation that is much further away from being fully convective. I'm going to start it in a second. On the left, you're going to see the compositional field. And on the right, you're going to see the velocity field in the x direction. And for reference, the x direction is in this way. Okay? So you're going to see the color scheme is going to measure the flows going this way and that way. So at the very beginning, you can see very small-scale turbulence as well, just like we saw in the other case. But now you can see that, or rather, what you won't see is a transition into a layered system. What happened is that the small-scale wave turbulence, and I should be careful using that word in the audience, becomes larger scale. So you have a transition from the small scale to the large scales, but you still have waves. The sampling time of the movie is not great, but you can see the phase planes propagating downwards. And here, this is a kind of one wavelength in this direction, and then zero wavelengths in this direction. And about four in the vertical direction. Now, a little while, you can now see that this is no longer oscillating. And now you've just formed, we've just formed a permanent shear layer with flow moving into the board this way and out of the board at the bottom. Okay? And you can see it's pretty persistent. At the very end, it starts being disturbed again. So this is an example. Instead of forming compositional layers, you can see the composition doesn't know about the presence of the shear layer, right? Instead of forming a compositional layer, we've just formed a shear layer. So just to recap, in the systems that are very close to being overturning unstable, I guess I'll skip that. Now I can't. So in the systems that are very close to be overturning unstable, we formed a layer in the compositional field. And the systems that are further away from being overturning unstable, we kept having large-scale gravity waves in the compositional field, as shown here. But in the velocity field, we started creating permanent shear layers. But not in the vertical. I don't know. I really don't know. So this is very recent stuff. we haven't run many simulations. We have two or three simulations that go into layers, and part of the reason is that it seems, sorry, that go into shear layers, and it seems that you need to have very low Prandtl number runs to get them. Okay, and these are more expensive than high Prandtl number runs, of course. Okay, and this kind of differentiation between layers in the composition versus no layer in composition, but instead large-scale waves and perhaps shear flow is ubiquitous. You get this across the board. So this is different simulations showing the Nusselt number as a function of time for varying Prandtl number going downwards. So 0.3, 0.1, 0.03, 0.01, and for increasing density ratio going this way. And you can see that for the low density ratio, you always get this increase that in Nusselt number that is stepwise. So here, step and step. Whereas for very high density ratios, you have these waves and a lot of variability in the Nusselt number. And part of that variability is attributed to wave phase locking. And part of that variability is attributed to the creation of these permanent shear layers that actually affect the heat flux through the system. And I'll show that in a minute. So this is now the sort of same diagram as I showed before, but a little bit expanded. So in the case where you're stably stratified, sorry, in where you have a stabilizing compositional gradient, you now split the double diffusive region into two, one which is layered and one which is not layered, and in terms of the composition. And in here, you have the possibility of generating mean flows. So this is the work on understanding the staircase formation is something that we've been doing for many years, and I understand it quite well. And this is actually stemmed from a collaboration with Timo Ratko that started quite a while ago now. So the emergence of staircases in double diffusive convection, whether it is oscillatory double diffusive convection that I showed you here, or whether it is fingering convection, which happens in another region of parameter space, can be basically understood using mean field theory, and that was this idea developed by Timor. And so the idea is very simple. If you have a basic state of homogeneous double diffusive convection, and you perturb it with very large-scale temperature and, say, compositional perturbations, these perturbations affect the density ratio. So some regions of your big domain will be slightly more stably stratified, and some regions will be slightly less stably stratified. And that induces a perturbation in the turbulent fluxes that then react back in these perturbations. And so for this cycle to work, I mean, sometimes this will be a positive feedback loop. Sometimes this will not be a positive feedback loop. But different feedback loops lead to different mean field instabilities. And this layering instability that I showed you earlier is one such feedback loop. But just be aware that there's other ones as well. And at the heart of this model is a scale separation between the tiny double diffusive scale and the large emerging scale. And to understand, so here I'm just going to look at the staircase formation. So I'm going to consider only horizontally invariant mean fields. So if you horizontally averaged the temperature and the salinity equation, you just get something very simple like that. So the temperature, the temporal evolution of the temperature and salinity fields are just given by the divergence of their fluxes. And so you have a standard closure problem. If you know the fluxes, you know how to evolve the large-scale fields. So what Timur suggested is that you can write the temperature flux and the salt flux in the following way. And right now, it's just a notation, right? There's no assumption in there. So the temperature flux is related to the local temperature gradient through the Nusselt number. And the salinity flux is related to the temperature flux through this parameter called gamma minus one. It's the inverse flux ratio. And of course, these equations look really simple, but all the details are in these function Nusselt and gamma minus one, of course, because these could be functions of the local temperature gradient and of the local salinity gradient. The assumption here is that it's only a function of the combination of these two numbers through the density ratio. Okay, so that's where the assumption comes in. And the assumption is also that we know what these functions are. And the so this R minus 1 is the local inverse density ratio. And so you can see it's this nonlinear combination of the salinity gradient and the local temperature gradient. Now, so this is just to repeat these equations here. So that's the closed model in some sense. And this set of nonlinear equations has a trivial solution where all these fields, the background, the large-scale temperature field, the large-scale salinity field, are zero, where all these fluxes are constant, where the density ratio is constant, and the flux, these things are constant. And this is basically the homogeneous solution, where you have turbulence, but the turbulence is spatially homogeneous. And this is what this early stages in the simulation look like, right? You have lots of small-scale stuff, and the Nusselt number is more or less constant for a while. And so this is where we measure the properties of the homogeneous turbulence. But of course, if you have small perturbations in the salinity field and the temperature field, then these induce small perturbations in the inverse density ratio. And the linearized version of this ratio is given here. The details are kind of irrelevant, but the one thing to care about is the fact that it's a bilinear function of the salinity gradient and the temperature gradient. Now, you can then proceed through a lot of not very complicated algebra to derive what's called the gamma instability. Here, I'm going to zoom in to the one important step of that calculation that actually illustrates really well the nature of the instability. So if you take the salinity equation, and you just plug in the fact that the salinity flux is now the product of this function times the temperature flux, then you use the product rule to expand that. And I'm going to put this quantity here on the right-hand side. Now, to the lowest order, so in the perturbations, the heat flux is actually constant because it's the heat flux for a given density ratio times 1 minus the temperature perturbation, the gradient of the temperature perturbation. To the lowest order, to zeroth order, this is just R naught. And to lowest order, this is just 1. So you get that this is just a background homogeneous Nusselt number. This d gamma minus 1 by dz, if you use the chain rule, is d gamma minus 1 by dr minus 1 times dr minus 1 by dz. So it's this quantity times the spatial derivative of this, and you have a minus szz plus r naught minus 1 tzz. And you combine this and this to plug it back into this equation, and you end up with an equation for the evolution of the salinity field that has stuff, but on the right-hand side, oops, this equal 0 shouldn't be there. On the right-hand side, it has this term, Nusselt number of the background homogeneous double diffusive convection, d gamma minus 1 by dr times the second derivative of SCZ. So that has the form of a diffusion equation. But if this number is negative, then, of course, you will have an anti-diffusion. Okay? And this is not dissimilar to a Phillips mechanism, if you know of the Phillips mechanism. So this instability mechanism is simply predicting that you should excite modes provided that gamma minus 1 is a decreasing function of R minus 1. Just to recap, gamma minus 1 is the ratio of the salt flux to the heat flux, and R minus 1 is the ratio of the salinity gradient to the temperature gradient. So if this is negative, you enhance any initial perturbation. And once these perturbations in the sort of horizontally average temperature profile grow, they can, and in the salinity profile grow, they can create an inverse density gradient. And when that happens, you overturn into a fully formed staircase. And the staircase, by construction, is actually equally spaced in Z. And that's what we saw in the simulation. The steps initially started as equally spaced. So to test the theory,
you never used the linearized equations for the prime fields in this mean field.
So there are several steps to the theory. We now actually have a theory for why the Nusselt number varies in such a fashion with the inverse density ratio etc. But right now, I'm just saying, if we know what the variation of the Nusselt number with the density ratio, and if we know what gamma, how gamma varies with the density ratio, then we can predict whether layers form or not. But so far, the Nusselt number function and the gamma minus one function are empirical. And in fact, this is a plot that summarizes in all of our simulations how the inverse, how the flux ratio varies with the stratification. And you can see that there are some regions of parameter space, some regions of parameter space where it decreases, and some regions of parameter space where it increases. Yeah. Yeah. So precisely, we measure it here. So we measure it during the homogeneous phase. But like I say, we now actually have a first principle theory to explain the shape of these curves, but that's a bit going a bit too far. So here I've added on this plot as large symbol all the simulations that actually ended up exhibiting layer formation. So you can see that there's a complete one-to-one correspondence with the ones for which you have a significant decrease in d gamma by dr. D gamma by dr is very negative. So decreasing, you get layers. Increasing, you don't. Decreasing, you get layers, and increasing, you don't. The other thing, of course, you can be more quantitative and actually compare the predicted growth rates of the layering mode to what's seen in the simulation. So that's what's done here. This is as a function of time. It's a spectral power in the Fourier coefficients associated with the density for these layering modes. And the blue one is for a mode with three steps. And you can see that they grow at exactly, so this the wiggly line is the simulations and the dotted line is the theory. They grow at exactly the predicted rate. So there's a very nice, this is a very nice validation of the theory. So now I'm going to move to the case of the wave mean flow interaction for shear layer formation. And this is something I really only started looking at the last few weeks. So I apologize, it's not finished work. So Oliver summarized a couple of days ago very well that if you have lots of gravity waves, which we do, you can expect a generation of mean flows, either if these gravity waves are diffusive or if they are nonlinearly interacting with one another. And of course, we have both here. So we should be expecting the generation of mean flows. The question is, what is the actual origin of the mean flow we're seeing in the simulation? And that turns out to be much harder. So we've spent, with my students, probably 2 years thinking that it could be the first one, where you can describe the emergence of big, large-scale shear flow by a reduced system of fully nonlinear equations. And I've kind of given up on that theory. And very much more recently, I've started looking at it from the point of view of a mean field instability of the kind I just described for the emergence of staircases, and also from the point of view of quasi-linear theory. So I'll go through these two. And just as a little notation, I'm going to define, this is a mode triplet. So this is the wave number LMK. And I'm going to define for simplicity L index subscript n as 2 pi over Lx times the number n, which means a mode with L1 has one wavelength in the box, okay? And similarly, a mode with K2 has two wavelengths in the vertical in the box. So this mode here is kind of like L1, 0, K2, because there's looks like it's invariant, at least on the large scales, in the y direction. And so because of that, the shearing modes, sorry, have a structure that's 0, 0, kn, right? So a shearing mode with just one oscillation is going to be 0, 0, k1, et cetera. So here is kind of what the data says. This is time here, and in red, and this is logarithmic, so in red is the kinetic energy in all the modes in the system. So the total kinetic energy in the simulation per unit volume. And you can see that there's this initial growth of the basic oscillatory instability. Then there's something weird happening. And then it continues to grow. And you can see already this is not a saturated simulation. Interestingly, so if you look at the kinetic energy in the shearing mode with one wavelength and in the shearing mode with two wavelengths, so these are the ones we actually saw appear in the simulation, their kinetic energy grows exponentially, very regularly, for quite a while. And then something happens, and they actually pick up even more amplitude. And when it really dominates the system, the heat flux suddenly drops. So that explains some of the variability we're seeing in the heat fluxes for some of these simulations. And again, this is why we might be interested in this. But the question is really, what causes this exponential growth here? So because this looks really similar to what we saw for the gamma instability, I started thinking, well, we could do something very similar by analogy. And this is an idea that was actually proposed by Timur a really long time ago. He said, well, the gamma instability can work for everything. I just don't know if he's actually pursued that. But so we're just going to proceed exactly as before. So we have, and this time I'm just going to ignore composition because you can treat it separately. If you're going to have an equation for the evolution of the mean temperature profile, and an equation for the horizontally average temperature profile, and an evolution equation for the horizontally average horizontal flow. And as before, we just say that the heat flux is just Nusselt number times the local temperature gradient. And we're going to say that this momentum flux is going to be a constant times, sorry, not a constant, a function times Ft. Now, Ft and F nu now depend on the inverse density ratio as before, on the Prandtl number and tau, but also on the local non-dimensional shearing rate. And this non-dimensional shearing rate, I'm going to define it like this. So it's going to be the uz divided by square root of pr times 1 minus r0 minus 1. If you're wondering about, sorry, this should be r0 minus 1 minus 1. If you're wondering why this formula, it's basically like one of the square root of the Richardson number, but signed so that it actually knows about the direction of the shear. And by using all of this together, we're following exactly the same steps as we did for the gamma instability. You can prove that you have instability of an anti-diffusive type, provided d sigma by d zeta, so provided the turbulent momentum flux is an increasing function of the shearing rate. Provided that is true, you get an anti-diffusive properties. So in the case for the gamma instability, we've been working on about this for years. We had really good data. Here, we just started thinking about this a couple of weeks ago, and so we don't have good data on measuring this turbulent flux as a function of the shearing rate. We don't even have the right code for it. But what we could do is take a simulation in a saturated state of homogeneous double diffusive convection and gradually force it with the horizontal shear flow. So this is the initial state in this saturated state. And then we add a forcing term to the equations and force a shear flow. So this is what it looks like a little bit later. You can already see there's the perturbations have been localized in the regions of little shear. And then you take these simulations, and at each position in space in Z and at each time snapshot in time, you measure both the turbulent momentum flux and the shearing rate, and you plot them against one another as parametric curves. So the blue curve is a particular instant in time, and all the additional curves are just lots and lots of instants in time. And you can see that for low shearing rates, you actually have an increasing curve, but for higher shearing rates, you have a decrease. Now, I don't understand why these kinks are in these positions, incidentally. I don't even understand why it's increasing, but this is what the data says. So in that region, for low shearing rate, you could actually get this kind of anti-diffusive properties. And so this instability, what you would call sigma instability, can be excited. Now, one of the things that's nice is that you can see that the derivative here seems to be independent of the shearing rate. It's very much like a straight line. And that would explain why, while the shear is ramping up, the growth rate of the shear also isn't changing, as we saw earlier. The other thing that's kind of nice is that this instability has self-regulating properties in the sense that when the shear gets too big, then suddenly you actually turn it off because the derivative changes sign. And that might explain why in some of these simulations, when the shear gets too big, over here it starts decreasing again. Sorry, it's not very visible on this logarithmic plot. But the shear starts decaying again over here. On the bad side, the growth rate of the mode with two wavelengths actually is the same as that with one wavelength, which contradicts the anti-diffusive nature of the instability. Whereas you'd expect modes with more wavelength to be more unstable than modes with one wavelength, because all these instabilities, the gamma instability and this one, suffer from an ultraviolet catastrophe. So that might not be right. And in any case, we need to test the theory further by measuring sigma of zeta carefully and systematically in lots of simulations, and actually calculating the growth rate with a full linear analysis and comparing it with the simulations, which, again, we haven't had time to do yet. But at least there's some promising aspects to that. Now, I just very quickly want to look into this alternative theory, which is the quasi-linear theory, because, again, many people have mentioned that in that meeting. So here the idea is, you have a basic instability, which is the oscillatory double diffusive instability, but you can ask the question, how is it modified by a shear flow? And then, of course, these modified perturbations can react back on the shear flow through the effect of Reynolds stresses. And so by coupling these two equations to one another, you might get an explanation for the acceleration of the shear. So you can calculate these perturbations using Floquet theory, and you can get the growth rate of the perturbations as a function of the horizontal wave number. And the main reason for this plot is to show that if you crank up the velocity of the shear up into a certain value, it doesn't really change the growth rate of the basic instability. So the shear doesn't really affect its growth rate. If, of course, the shear is really big, you start exciting real shear instabilities, and the curve becomes very different. But what the shear actually does is to localize the perturbations, and we saw that in that nonlinear simulation earlier, but from Floquet theory, you can find that the perturbations are localized in regions of no shear. And so then you can calculate.
What's the difference between the bar and
two? Oh, this is without any shear, and that's with shear.
Okay.
And here you can see that the perturbations are indeed localized where the shear is minimum. And then you can look at the input of energy into the mean flow from this equation. So you project the mean flow onto the horizontally averaged momentum equation. And you can see that there's a diffusive term that will always go against the growth of the mean flow. And then you have the Reynolds stress term. And it's basically the product of the shear times the horizontal average of the Reynolds stress. And you can calculate that quantity for lots of different values of L, for lots of different values of the imposed shear flow. And you can find that there's a significant region of parameter space where this quantity is strictly positive, which is, again, what you need in order to enhance the shear. But there's a problem. It's a big problem, is that the growth rate of a mode is symmetric in L. So modes with plus L and modes with minus L grow at exactly the same rate. But this nonlinear term that I show is antisymmetric in L. So modes with plus L will accelerate the flow, but modes with minus L will decelerate the flow. So in order to have a systematic acceleration, somehow you need to have an asymmetry between modes with plus L and modes with minus L. But they both grow at the same rate. So what causes this asymmetry? And I have no idea. In the actual simulation, if you calculate the nonlinear term, so the one I showed earlier, you actually do get that it is positive. And of course, because it's positive, it has a tendency to accelerate the mean flow. So that's the kinetic energy in the mean flow.
Could you remind what's L?
The horizontal wave number in the x direction. So in the direction of the shear. So I don't know what causes this asymmetry, but it is there. And I think that remains an open problem. But it is kind of promising because that could also explain the growth of the shear. So to summarize, so oscillatory double diffusive convection has example of strong interaction between small scales giving rise to large scales, both in the compositional field and in the mean flow. Mean field theory does explain the formation of staircases in the buoyancy profile. And shear layers are observed to form for low enough Prandtl number in the more wave-like region of parameter space for these oscillatory double diffusive systems. Now, candidates for the shear layer formation have been identified, so it's either the sigma instability or the quasi-linear theory. The one thing that distinguishes the two is this one requires scale separation between large and small scales, and this one doesn't really require scale separation. So maybe one way of figuring out whether it's this one or the other is to try and see if we can suppress some scales and verify whether the instability still exists or not. But in either way, both kinds of these instabilities will have important implications for interior planet structure, and we know that already in the case of the gamma instability, but now I'm starting to think it might have influence on the dynamics as well through the generation of main flows. That's it.
I have time for questions.
In the numerical simulation, after the layers emerge, there's a very interesting phenomenology where they merge and form bigger and bigger layers. So if you integrate your system, you know, your mean field system, does that happen in the the model that you proposed?
There's two answers to your question. The first one is we've never integrated the mean field system in a nonlinear sense, right? But the other is that the mean field system, as written, does not have a formulation for the fluxes through the interfaces. And you need to create one in order to do what you suggest. And so we've been looking at trying to find a way of teasing out of the data what is the flux through the interface rather than the flux through. And also, sorry, I forgot to mention that once you're in the layered stage, you're no longer semi-convective. You're no longer oscillatory convective. You're fully convective in the layer. And you're not at all convective in interface. So you completely change the way your Nusselt number and your gamma is. So before doing what you suggest, we would actually need to have a different parameterization for the heat fluxes and salinity fluxes in the layer and in the interface. Now, Timur Ratko did that. And he proposed an ad hoc parameterization for both, right? He proposed the flux law for the layers and the flux law for the interface. And then he did this evolution of the mean field equation and found that for his particular parameterization, you get into a stable staircase height. But there's reasons to question his parameterization. And again, we've been trying to.
So the merging stopped and you just ended up
with
that.
So in his model, the merging stops. But we have a quick look at our data shows that his parameterization probably doesn't work. And we haven't been able to extract a good way of, to find a good way of extracting these fluxes from the simulation directly. And we don't have a model for fluxes through the interface either. It's quite complicated, their dynamics. So a lot to be done there.
There's a question on the right.
All right. I had a kind of a question and a comment. It seems that your d gamma minus 1, dr minus 1 condition, is it fair to say that that's equivalent to saying the relevant flux is bistable in the gradient? You know, you could think of the case where you have your thing going positive as the positive slope of an S-curve, but eventually it has to go to some sort of stationary state. So you can think of it basically as a process of switching from one, the initial state to the staircase state as the two stable states. Is so that a fair way to think about things?
If we fix the fluxes, you have two stable states in terms of the gradients. Is that what you're thinking?
Yeah, exactly.
I have not thought about it in these terms. And part of the problem here, at least for our system, is we're always imposing a global gradient. Whereas I think for what you're doing, you'd have to have a self-consistent
right.
global
no, that's,
system, right?
Yeah.
But that's quite possible that it would work way in a self-consistent one.
It seems like it's a transition between two states, mm-hmm. right? And the transition producing the steps. The second question or comment about your concern about symmetry in the Reynolds stress, if you think of computing the Reynolds stress with the total fluctuation of the linear mode plus the response of the linear mode to the shear flow, that second term, I bet you, will not suffer from your concern about bidirectional things and will give an unambiguous contribution.
Right.
So you might try doing that.
And in order to do this properly, we need to have an estimate of the amplitude of the perturbation, which
right.
is a bit harder. But you're right, that's probably the way to get it.
Your formation of the multiple layers, of course, is a major step forward some time ago. Could you speculate how the oceans choose to do it so that they have a thermohaline staircase that might have 20 steps in it, as we see in the, say, the Mediterranean outflow? Would your calculations need very much taller vertical scales or something like this so that you don't end up having just one interface in the long term?
Okay, so the answer to that question is a bit complicated in the sense that there are two types of staircases in the ocean. There are the ones in the tropics that are associated with fingering convection, and the ones in the polar ocean that are maybe associated with oscillatory double diffusive convection, but more likely associated with lateral intrusions. In the lateral intrusions case, I don't think there is an obvious evidence for mergers that occur in the same way that we have in this natural double diffuse oscillatory case. So for the polar ocean, I think the answer lies somewhere else. For the staircases in the fingering region, actually, we don't see mergers in the simulation. So again, we don't have that problem. It's kind of the opposite in the sense that we'd like to see mergers in the simulation so we could study them, but we run them as long as we can, and they don't look like they want to merge. So
you have some cases where you get multiple layers and they do not merge.
In the fingering case. But the problem is that the time scales have, I mean, these are really, really difficult simulations to run. It could be that if we integrated longer, maybe we would see mergers, right? But the one simulation where we have layer formation in the fingering regime, we've integrated as we could, and the number of layers stayed the same.
And there's one more question.
However, there's one indication is that we make prediction for the height of the layer at formation, and it's something of the order of a meter or two, whereas the ones in the ocean are much thicker than that. So something must happen in between these two stages.
Okay. Thank you. This is very nice work. My question is, in real astrophysical environments, such as the cores of giant planets or near the edge of a helium-burning core in a star, which regimes do we expect to find ourselves in, that where you get the staircases or
that's a really good
the
question.
Non-layered?
Where am I? Well, it doesn't matter. The layered regime is the widest, and it spans most of the double diffusive range. For stellar interiors, in fact, it's spanning the wave-like regime is practically, you can ignore it for all intents and purposes. So for all intents and purposes, in stellar evolution codes, you can assume you're in a layered stage. In the planetary interiors, I would say the wave-like regime is about a third of the range of the total double diffusive regime. So you expect layers closer to convection, but there's a definite region of parameter space where you might expect waves on shear layers.
What's different about the two cases?
The Prandtl number.
The Prandtl number.
So in stellar interiors, the Prandtl number is very low. In planetary interiors, we're talking 10 to the minus 7, 10 to the minus 6. In planetary interiors, it's more like 10 to the minus 3, 10 to the minus 2. And so the relative ranges for each of these types of behavior is different.
Getting back to the ocean, these double diffusive layers in the polar oceans we were talking about maybe 20 staircases, but they're remarkably long-lived. They stretch for hundreds of kilometers. In the data, you can see like a big internal wave propagating through them, and they remain as a stable unit. So I'm not surprised there are some cases where they don't merge. The mystery is why they don't under those circumstances.
So I really want to come back to this number, which you should always bear in mind, is that unstable range to oscillatory double diffusive convection is completely negligible for water. I mean, and these staircases in the polar ocean have density ratios much, much higher than that. So they're outside of that range most of the time.
Did you use the actual nonlinear equation of state for seawater?
No,
you
we
make
didn't.
That statement?
That could actually be an issue, yeah.
Because, I mean, the quadratic nonlinearity at low temperature is really strong.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's based on a linear state.
Yeah.
Any further questions? Okay.
Lewis? In cases like the Mediterranean outflow, there is, of course, a finite time for a particle to travel through the whole system, so maybe it just doesn't have time to do any merging. Is that possible?
Again, my impression is that the Mediterranean outflow is dominated by intrusive instabilities rather than intrinsic fingering instabilities, although I could be wrong with that.
I take it you're beneath the outflow, so it is a fingering situation.
Right.
Okay, can we thank Pascal again and all of this morning's speakers?